Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lau.
So we've got some really timely movie reviews going on here. We all finally saw Avengers and Dark Knight.
No, I think I was the only holdout. I hadn't seen Dark Knight Rises.
So it's your fault.
It's all my fault. I saw it on Saturday.
All right. What'd you think?
Oh, I liked it. So I now can weigh in on the burning question of 2012, which was better, The Avengers or Dark Knight Rises.
Was that a burning question? I hadn't heard anybody ask it before you.
When Avengers came out, a lot of people compared it to Dark Knight Rises.
Mm.
And at least among our group of friends, people were comparing Avengers quite favorably, saying that it was much better.
Do you disagree?
Well, one of them was made by this generation and any generation's greatest filmmakers, and the other was made by Joss Whedon.
Ouch.
Oh, that's hard. Oh,
jeez, and I thought I had a wicked burn before the cast. Ouch.
Honestly, I think it... Night and day. Whoa.
Whoa.
Dark Knight. Whoa. That was totally unintentional.
Right. The ideas that just flow out of my head. Quick, write them down.
Even when I'm asleep, I'm like... No, I really thought that Dark Knight Returns was a really tight movie. I thought it ended the trilogy. It almost seemed like they planned it, even though they weren't sure if they were going to do a third movie, but it's almost like from the get-go, they were going to do this particular trilogy because it seemed so seamless. And I think predicting here, the Avengers will seem like just three movies put together.
Is the Avengers actually going to be three parts?
It's probably going to be inevitable. Like, it's probably going to be a trilogy or four movies
or whatever. They're going to make as many parts as they can get away with.
Right.
Yeah. I thought, the level of acting, the set pieces, all of it. I just thought Dark Knight Returns is head and shoulders over Avengers. I mean, there's like moments in Avengers. I'm starting to rant now.
Uh-oh, watch out.
No, it's like in Avengers, it's like a lot of it just didn't make sense. And it wasn't fun enough to make you say whatever. Like a movie like Battleship was a lot of fun. So you're just like, I don't care.
Right.
And you just enjoy it. And in Avengers, it was just like, you know, when Banner goes, oh, I'm always angry. And at first you're like, yeah. And you're like, what? Hold on, what? Like, what about, like, halfway through the movie? Like, actually, I saw it with my wife, and after the movie, she's like, sorry, what did that mean? Like, he's always angry, and he was angry. Like, remember he became the Hulk? I don't know. And then Joss Whedon gets all this credit for, like, strong female characters. But I think if you compare the female characters in Dark Knight Rises with Avengers, it's just no comparison.
I don't know. That's hard to say. I agree that The Dark Knight was overall a better movie. It had much, much better cinematography. The settings, the way the movie was put together, the whole look of the film and the acting as well were really, really, really good. I mean, it was a great piece of work. But
what's left?
Yeah, what's left? What's left for the Avengers to be good about?
Well,
But the color palette in the Avengers is more varied. Yeah.
I enjoyed the Avengers more. Just watching it, I had more fun with that one than I did with Batman.
So overall, it was a worse movie, but you know what? I liked it better.
Well,
I'm hearing.
I mean, that's actually the case. I mean, I totally agree. There's nothing that makes The Avengers a better movie. I can't say anything. The acting, Christian Bale, the way he reads Batman's lines, Steve, is a little bit wanting. But regardless of that aside, yeah, I can't really think of anything that makes The Avengers better, but I really did enjoy it more.
I was a big critic of Christian Bale and how he does Batman's lines, but maybe it took me three movies and to finally get it, but it was like, oh, he's disguising his voice, like, really a lot.
Well, yes he is.
Except everybody was able to guess who he was, except for Commissioner Gordon. Just like,
yeah, the Batman.
Oh, hold
everyone
on.
Everyone knows you're Batman.
I'd like a pack of gum.
Whatever you want, Mr. Wayne.
Yeah. What do you think, Wayne?
No, I agree with you. Like, overall, I think Dark Knight Rises was a better movie. I don't know. The Avengers felt like, because I saw it in the theater, it felt like it was really long. Especially the fight scene at the end. I'm like, oh, geez.
Wasn't that the worst alien invasion ever? I mean, it was Signs. With, like, what did you really expect to accomplish on your jet ski?
Yeah, that was, I don't know. That was pretty bad. And the setup, not the setup, but like the ending was kind of lame. You know, where all you do is turn off the machine. It's like, all right. But yeah, that battle scene at the end was just like way too long, and I don't know. I guess I'm kind of like Chris, but on the opposite side, like I can't really think of why I didn't like Avengers, other than I just kind of didn't like it. You know.
I don't know. It seemed to manage to take an actor like Chris Evans, who's one of the few guys who can do action and comedy, and seemed to rob him of all his comedic timing and his ability to do that. I mean, the only laughs out of the movie came out of the Hulk.
Right.
Now, I expect like Chris Hemsworth to be a piece of wood because he was in that Thor movie. But
and
have like
Thor again.
Chris Evans do that? Yeah, it was one of those things. It's like, let's have the aliens invade. And it's funny, like, you compare it to a movie that got bagged, which would be Battleship.
Right.
And at least you're like, no, you know, they were scouts.
Yeah.
And it kind of made sense, and they kind of,
No, you are not going there. You're not going there and saying that Battleship made more sense than the Avengers. Come on, the red and green thing?
The alien invasion,
Look, these solid cement pillars, they are dangerous. We should attack them. Oh, this young boy, he is not dangerous. I won't attack him. Come on.
Hey, we didn't say their attack. We said the invasion made more sense. You send down this force first, and then you bring people later on.
Granted, that part made more sense, but that was...
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. And it's like, but there, it was like, you have all these, like...
Giant trilobites?
I'm not ruining anything, but I think everybody knows, but it's like just like one of the most iconic villains, supervillains, in the Marvel Universe. And he's involved in an invasion that has jet skis.
Sorry,
and
flying
you're just like,
jet skis.
Really? And he goes, oh, they're going to come. It's like endless jet skis. And you're like, all right, bring it on. I hope you have something with, you know, a closed cockpit. So your pilots are somewhat protected. Nope. There were some funny things, like, you know, funny, unintentionally funny things in Dark Knight Rises, like the death or exile. And the guy's like, well, I'm definitely not going to go walk on the ice. So you're choosing death. Like, that makes no sense. I'm not going to risk walking on the ice as opposed to like a bullet in the back of the head or whatever.
But hey, he might be able to survive that. You don't survive a plunge through freezing water. Like,
yeah. And then the ice seems to be pretty solid when they're walking.
Yeah, it did.
Like, what's the problem?
Yeah.
Well, there's that weird bit where they're walking out of this really apparently very thin ice that people fall through all the time, and Batman shows up with a flare and drops it on the ice. Good idea.
that was funny. He's coming from the opposite side. And, oh, hey, yeah. Batman. Yeah. Or how Bruce Wayne managed to
he can walk
go
on water.
From like some Middle Eastern country to Gotham.
Yeah, that right. That got me too. When he climbed out of the pit and he's just like walking off, I'm like, so it's right next to Gotham? Because how he's going to get home?
You have my permission to escape.
The deleted scene where the prisoners chuck up his passport and yeah. Big wad of cash. You'll need this to book the flight.
Batman, don't forget your ticket.
Yeah.
When he throws down the rope, there's all these like rapists and murderers.
All right.
It's like, you're free now. Yeah, so I mean,
so yeah, that made a lot more sense than jet skis.
Oh, come on. You know what? It did. It did.
I felt like it was really rewarding, and it just managed to, like, you know, usually the third movie is, like, one of the weaker movies. Mm-hmm. And it manages to be, like, certainly better than the first movie and arguably better than the second movie.
Really? I'd have to disagree. Because, like I said, the Batman movie had really good production, and it was a very good movie. But I think the second movie was the best of the three. That's just my
opinion. I'm not going to argue, because I know I have a minority opinion here. Mm. My hang-up with the second movie was that I felt Two-Face was wasted.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I totally agree. I know
what they were doing. They were taking the Killing Joke. Instead of using Commissioner Gordon, they were using Harvey Dent. Mm. And, yeah, I got it, but then I was like, oh, no, you can't use Two-Face anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just like, it was kind of like Joker's show, and just let him have it.
Yeah, and for somebody who's maybe not familiar with the Batman series at all, who doesn't know who Two-Face is, they could have been left kind of confused by that, I imagine.
Yeah. But. And whereas, like, in the third movie, I didn't feel like Catwoman was tacked on or Selina Kyle.
No.
I felt she was used really well, and the combination of the other two villains was really good, one being Bane.
Yeah.
It was pretty interesting reimagining of Bane, hey?
I thought it was an excellent reimagining, and it was good that the show had a genuine surprise, a nice twist, so, yeah, I really liked that. Mm. Like, I was actually, I felt like, you know, he did it. And I mean, that's Christopher Nolan. I mean, anyone who's seen The Prestige, still his best movie, knows that he can really deliver. And you can watch The Prestige over and over again. And, you know, you're just finding more and more little things to appreciate.
More of it to love every time.
Whereas Joss Whedon, what's he done? He's done like what, Dollhouse?
Joss Whedon's good. I really like him. He did Firefly. That's one of the greatest sci-fi series, despite being cut short, that I've ever seen.
I didn't like the director's commentary where he whined about it being cut short.
Never watched the director's commentary.
Yeah, same here.
Then don't.
Well, I was going to say what you will about Joss Whedon in commentary, but I think Michael Bay has a beat for annoying commentary in a movie.
If it's anything annoying, Michael Bay wins hands down.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say. Anyone listen to the commentary on Transformers? Oh, man, talk about an ego.
Anybody watch Transformers a second time? Third time? Usually a commentary is like a second or third time you watch a movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you want good commentaries, Escape from New York is excellent. Excellent.
Flash Gordon, if you listen to the Brian Blessed commentary, it is fantastic. And that's me! Ha ha!
That's good. Actually, Fellowship of the Ring has really good commentary if you put it on The Hobbits.
Mm-hmm. So it'd be like Elijah Wood. People.
Which I was in the process of naming, but whatever. But they're really funny. So, and yeah, they have some funny stuff. And I think Orlando Bloom may be on that commentary with him. And yeah, whatever. I mean, it was like one of his first big role, and he's very, very enthusiastic. I forget what word he uses, but he just uses, kind of sticks to that. Like, it was amazing. But his enthusiasm is infectious, but you really just want to put mute in every.
It was really, yeah, totally.
Thanks. Let me guess, amazing? Oh, yeah, you've seen it.
So speaking of Hobbits, I saw The Hobbit, over the weekend.
Was it amazing?
I thought it was good. Did not feel like 3 hours. Like when, you know, the final scene ended and, you know, theater went black, I'm like, wow, that didn't really feel long at all. And then I looked at my clock and I'm like, holy crap, yeah, it was 3 hours. So
That's very high praise.
I realized there was a lot of people wondering how the movie would look when it was filmed at like 48 frames per second. They were worried it looked like a TV soap opera. Apparently that's only with the 3D. I saw it in 2D, which probably explains why I didn't notice anything different with the film. So,
where did you go to see it?
I saw it at the Toho Cinema Theater here in Nam.
I heard that the only places that were showing it in the 48 frames per second were in Nagoya and in Tokyo. Hmm. They didn't have anything in Osaka for it, so you might have only seen it at 24. But not that I'm sure that they're only showing in those two places. Maybe they're showing it there too. But
so should I spend my money to watch it in the theater, or can I wait till the DVD?
I would spend money to see it in the theater just because, I don't know, I think movies kind of lose something when you see them on the small screen with your small home speakers. Unless you have like a giant home theater set up with a decent sound, then, you know, those kind of like sweeping epics. I don't know, I think having that booming sound that kind of like rattles your chair and that big screen adds something to the movie. So I think it's worth it if you catch a late show where it's cheaper than normal.
Cool.
All right, for our next creature feature, we're doing fairies. Like ghosts and vampires, fairies are quite varied, so rather than trying to give like an exhaustive list of all the different types of fairies, we've pulled some key elements, or some interesting elements that you can use in your game if you're going to use fairies.
And we're going to try and keep as far away from elves as possible.
Yeah, we're not going to talk much about elves. Perhaps elves can get their own episode at a later date. Mm-hmm. Just because elves have been, more than any other fairy, redefined by people like Tolkien and every other fantasy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, seeing as how every other fantasy just about was inspired by Tolkien, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I suppose elves still are fairies, but yeah, just not today.
Not today!
Legolas, what do your fairy eyes see?
Before we get into the elements, we're going to first do an overview of what the fairies kind of are. Chris?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of different ways for it. Like, just as Lyle said, the definition of what a fairy is too wide and varied to pin down to any one thing. But some of the more common descriptions of the nature of fairies is that they're dead creatures or undead creatures, most commonly similar to ghosts. If you're thinking like the Banshee or Will of the Wisps, some cultures see them as demons, little tiny devils that run around. Others have described them as kind of fallen angels, but not quite evil enough to go to hell, but not good enough to be in heaven, so kind of in between. Some see them as just natural creatures or kind of creatures of the elements. And one of the ones that I thought was most interesting was, I think it was an Irish legend that they were the native people of that land before, you know, all the humans moved in. And they were kind of conquered and destroyed by the humans, so they had to go into hiding, which also explains why they're small and invisible and things like that.
Yeah, kind of one of the other I guess, origins of fairies I heard, but that they were kind of, you know, ancient goddesses and gods that then kind of got diminished because of Christianity. Again, mm-hmm. that was mostly in Ireland.
Yeah, I was actually pretty surprised by how widespread the whole fairy mythology was. Because the ones that I've grown up with is the same that everything's with, like, leprechauns and little winged creatures and stuff. And I always thought of them as, like, Celtic and, at least around the British area, those kinds of myths. But they're really all over the place. There, I was reading, even in the Middle East, they had kind of an Islamic version of them. And here's an interesting one. They were called peris. Very similar to fairies, but they were kind of that purgatory angel, the in between heaven and hell angel creature.
Yeah, I think like part of the problem in doing research in that, yeah, fairies are such a broad category and sometimes like so ill defined that you could even say like, are nymphs or other kind of nature spirits, are they considered fairies as well? And then, as you said, Chris, yeah, like other cultures have nature spirits and kind of these other things that could technically be classified as fairies, I guess, where, yeah kind of like you, I always assumed that fairies were limited to mm-hmm. the European area, no? I guess growing up with those fairy tales.
Yeah.
So they really could be anything you want them to be, pretty much.
Yeah, and not even just origins, but also their descriptions, what they look like. You can go all the way from, you know, goblins, these mean little ugly creatures, to sylphs, who are, you know, small, winged, beautiful humanoid creatures. And then you can go all those things, some things that are huge, like ogres and monsters like that. Even giants were considered among fairies in some myths.
Yeah, trolls.
Trolls, yeah. So really, anything!
Yeah. What is a fairy? Anything you want it to be.
All right, I see a lot that people can use.
Perhaps too much.
Yeah. It's a fairy dragon, deal with it.
Actually, there is one of those, isn't there, in D&D?
That's probably everything in D&D.
Yeah, right.
Hey, it's an owl and a bear. Let's mash it together. There you go.
Yeah. But we'll be looking at some of the common traits that are found amongst all the different kinds of fairies as maybe better ways of defining and classifying and building the fairies to use in your game.
The first thing is cold iron. Or another thing is just iron, as they, mm-hmm. you'd normally call it. It's the same thing.
Yes, yes. It must have been D&D, I think, that I read it somewhere that cold iron, quote-unquote, is defined as... iron that was wrought into a weapon while still cold, hadn't been heated beforehand. So all the way up until, you know, just looking into it for this episode, that's what I'd always thought it was. But it turns out, no, it's just iron, because it's cold to the touch.
Cold to the touch.
Yeah.
After you make it.
Exactly. Oh, really?
Just like cold steel. Cold steel.
Oh, I actually didn't know that. Yeah, I assumed that cold iron was...
special iron.
Yeah, exactly. And I think part of that got propagated by the Changeling, the Lost book. And then mm-hmm. game that I ran, because that's what the White Wolf setting considers to be cold iron. Iron that was beat into shape only by sheer muscle power without being heated.
Right.
I don't know. I think, maybe any iron works, but, you know, that kind of makes it less special, you know?
Not necessarily, because then when you look at, like, some of the things that have been done with, like, iron, it's like iron gates around a cemetery to keep the spirits in.
Right.
Iron horseshoes.
Yeah,
over a door to keep the spirits out. I mean, we're used to like with vampires and that, to have different, I guess, wards. Mm-hmm. And there's certain things or certain vulnerabilities, you know, silver and that. And I just think that because it is so common.
Right.
That it, I mean, silver is still pretty rare. I mean, but the fact that iron, it's so common that you could actually fashion an entire gate around cemeteries. Every town would do it.
Right.
So it's like a common vulnerability that everybody can get around. It's like salt. You know, you see that used a lot. Not in everyday life, but like in Supernatural, the ward off spirits and things like that. But, you know, it just makes it, you know, it's not kryptonite. It's not something that's unusually rare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the kind of thing like vampires in modern day with garlic. You know, you can run across garlic in any household, any restaurant, anything like that. It's the same kind of thing. I suppose in medieval settings, iron would be much more common. But you'd have to consider, if you were doing something more modern with the fairies, how common iron actually is, and whether alloys such as steel count or not.
No, that's a good point, and I think it means, like, depending on your setting, it means you have to deal with it in a different way. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, if like let's say it's a spice, and I don't know how rare garlic would be. Actually, I think garlic was fairly common wherever.
Right.
Like, even the Romans, at least in the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be fairly common.
Yeah.
But if you have something very common, how do you deal with it? If it becomes less common, then how do you deal with that?
Hmm.
And I think that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
One thing about the garlic, I mean, you saw that in Lost Boys. You know, when he's eating, the master vampire is eating spaghetti, and there's a lot of garlic in it. And he's like, oh, I love garlic.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of do away with that.
Right.
And I think when you play a game like Vampire and that, you're very much tempted to do away with that very common weakness.
Mm-hmm.
Or as you were saying, Wayne, the Changeling, you're very tempted to go, yeah, cold iron is something that's really rare, because who would fashion anything out of cold iron?
Exactly. Such a pain to make.
Right. But then it's like, no, it's everywhere. And then it's like, wow, that's something that we've really got to deal with. Mm-hmm. We always have to think about it. It is a vulnerability.
Yeah, look, I see your point now, because when you brought up like vampires, and the guys didn't say the obvious one, which is, hey, we can't go out in sunlight, which is half the day.
yeah, that's a bit more common than garlic, hey?
Yeah.
Not sure. I think they even had sunlight in the medieval times.
They might have. Yeah.
Really? When did they invent that?
Come on, I'm just being dry.
And Chris was beating that horse.
So yeah, there's really a lot to think about there, especially because it's the stories about fairies are much less defined. There's not really one kind of major pilot story about fairies like there is for vampires with Bram Stoker, for example.
That's an excellent point, yeah.
How does it work with this cold iron? You know, is it something that's by touch, or maybe the fairies can smell it or sense it or not be near it or something? Or is it only if it's used as a weapon, if it actually cuts them or draws blood? And like I said before, you know, what happens with alloys that contain iron?
That's a really good point, because sometimes, like, with the zombie movies or zombie TV series now, where it's like, you know, shoot him in the head, okay, we got it.
Mm-hmm.
Or everybody knows, okay, let's drive a stake through his heart. But yeah, with fairies, it's like, do they know it? Do they know about the cold iron? There's that element. And then after you know the cold iron, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And most people are like, well, what is it? Is it a special type of iron, or is it just everyday iron? And then you're like, sorry, what's this metal? Is this iron or stainless steel? Like,
yeah.
Is there any iron in this? Mm. You know, it actually brings up one of the problems with the everyday, you know, is that we don't really know how a lot of things are made.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
We know that something's silver because that's like a precious metal. We know something's gold because that's a precious metal, but no one thinks it's like steel. Says stainless steel. How much iron is in that?
None, because it's all stainless steel.
Oh. Yeah, it's like what goes into steel? Like people just don't think about those things anymore. And it, you know, we're talking about vulnerabilities, but it brings into maybe a larger issue is that fairies are very, I guess you could say, primal. Like you guys mentioned about the nature thing, but a fairy is like a very primal creature. It's, yeah, sure, it's natural, but it's not like an environmental thing. It's just like, it's kind of a reminder of what we were or what people before us were or whatever, however you want to take that.
Now that reminded me, again, in the Changeling book, or maybe one of the succubents, because the setting kind of is, I guess, animistic a little bit, where eventually you'll get to see, like, spirits. They came up with sort of three origin stories about why cold iron was an anathema to fairies, and they were all different versions, and I think that's something to bring into your game, too. Like, okay, if you're going to go with the cold iron thing, you know, why? I mean, you can think about how it affects, but also why does it affect them? Like, is there some, like, mythology that, you know, in there? Like, is there, I think one of the stories was, you know, fairies could make contracts with sort of, like, nature spirits, and they made a contract with iron, and then the fairies actually broke, you know, the contract either by accident or on purpose, and so iron said, okay, you know what, yeah, that's it, you guys are done. So, no more contracts, and I don't have to listen to you anymore, and that's kind of where the cold iron thing came from, and in one of the versions.
Wow, that iron really is cold.
Yeah. Oh, jeez.
Oh!
Do I get that rim shot, Wayne?
He's here all night, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. But also, as an aside to this all, you know, one of the things that's nice about fairies not being as well-defined as vampires or werewolves or whatnot, you can also have a lot of free rein as to what happens. Cold iron's not working for you? Yeah, whatever. Go with something else. Like hot iron.
Hot iron. I think that does anybody. Oh, crap. That's hot. Sorry.
It buries the fry pan.
No, but that's a good point. Like,
Fry pan.
Hey, cast iron skillet. There you go.
Yeah.
No, I'm just thinking it's like, hey, Japanese English.
Fry pan?
Frying.
Frying pan.
Been here so
long.
Didn't realize it. Now, what you said about, like, other things working, I think, like, cold iron is the big one, but then, like, in folklore and other stories, there's like lots of other stuff that would, you know, prevent fairies from bothering you, a lot of which is contradictory. So, yeah, other examples include like wearing clothes inside out, running water, just like vampires, bells, four-leaf clovers,
ash, certain different kinds of fruit and vegetables, depending on which region you're in.
Yeah, one is just like freshly baked bread.
Yes, yeah, I saw that one.
I understand why after reading it, because they said like making bread is kind of seen as human beings kind of conquering nature, and it also represents, you know, like home and the hearth, and you know, that we can make this, we kind of have dominion over all this stuff, and so it's kind of again would repel fairies, but then other stories say, hey, yeah, fairies love bread, so you're like, oh well, which one is it? So
yeah.
Isn't that like a Newfoundland folklore, the fairy, the bread thing?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised that Newfoundland would have like a fairy folklore. Because Newfoundland's not that old.
Alright, yeah.
Okay.
Right? There was like silence there.
waiting for you to say why.
Just your horrible racism versus Newfoundland.
Be like, no, it'd be like Boston has like a specific fairy folklore.
Well, that's not too weird. There's all kinds of urban mythology from even younger places. Bigfoot, that's out west. That's less than 100 years
decidedly
old.
Decidedly not a fairy.
What? Yeah, exactly. I was going to say.
Thanks, Wayne.
Loch Ness Monster, not a fairy.
Example of a mythological being that's more recent.
UFOs.
How do you know?
There's a lot of similarities there. Well, Wayne's already mentioned our second element, and that's contract.
Yeah, I saw this as contracts or also rules, because, yeah, as I said, fairies are kind of, I guess, known for making contracts, or they're also known for, at least what I would consider, playing by a set of rules that just no one else knows. So
they play by their own rules.
Yeah, exactly. They play by their own rules. So I think that leads to a lot of the contradictory nature or information about fairies that we get, where, again, assuming fairies are real, perhaps we just don't know what rules they follow, and so it seems like nothing they really do makes sense, but that's just because we can't understand what rules they follow and kind of what they do.
Yeah, just to like follow up on the contracts, there's also the kind of the element where they can't lie.
Yeah, yeah.
Which relates to the contracts, and that it's all about, it gets into loopholes and how they manipulate contracts and how they manipulate you and how you manipulate them.
Hey, so I think
to make a very good back and forth in your dealings with the fairies. And I think things like contracts aren't a common element that people incorporate into their games, but it's something that they should maybe consider.
Absolutely. And I like that you bring up loopholes as well, because I think that was one of the more interesting points of the contracts that I saw. In that, you know, a lot of these people, in a lot of the stories, people will make a contract with a fairy, sometimes even without realizing that they've made this kind of contract, and they have to find their way out. And of course, that's the dramatic arc of the story. But yeah, there's usually these small kinds of loopholes, or if I wear my shoes backwards on a certain Sunday, then the contract is null and void.
Well, plus, as Lyle said, like, it's kind of the honesty thing. Like, if you think of like a classic story like Rumpelstiltskin, right? You know, the queen got out of the contract she made with Rumpelstiltskin by finding out his true name. Spoilers! So, you know, and she sent someone to follow him, and the guy spied on Rumpelstiltskin and, you know, found out his name, came back and told the queen. And instead of saying, you cheated, you know, by sending someone to follow me, Rumpelstiltskin just had to abide by the contract, because he hadn't put anything in the rules that say, you know, you couldn't get it by stealth or whatever. So, and
yeah, that's right. One of the things that I think is pretty interesting about just supernatural creatures in general. This includes things like angels and demons, that they're bound by the whatever rules of the society or metaverse or whatever thing that they've come from. And I really like that idea where, you know, humans, we can lie, we can break contracts, you know, we can cheat in deals. If somebody finishes a contract that we've agreed upon, we can renege on it. I just really like the idea of a creature that it's physically impossible for them to do that kind of thing. They just can't lie. It's not part of who they are. I really enjoy that. Well, it's fun to play.
I guess I was also going to say the flip side of that is the contracts and the sort of rules that fairies set up don't allow for, not accidents, but they don't allow for any kind of slip up. Like, if you break a fairy contract by accident, it's still broken. You know, that was one of the things that I liked about the Changeling the Law setting. They had these contracts that you could build. And unfortunately, they were cool mechanics, but they were too in-depth to do during a game, which is when you would want to do them. So that kind of fell flat. But one of the good things is they said there was, like, you know, I forget what they call it, like the thing you couldn't do, or, you know, something that would break the contract. And Fate didn't care if you were unable to break it. You know, they didn't care if it was your fault or not. They didn't care if you had gotten kidnapped or, you know, you were, you know, prevented from doing this thing. If you broke it, you broke it, and you suffered the consequences. So
yeah, and as an addition to that, a lot of times the fairies don't even consider the abilities of the people that they're making contracts with. You know, a fairy can fly, a fairy can turn invisible, so they would make a contract maybe with the idea of that someone, the human that they're talking to, would be able to fly or turn invisible. They don't even consider the idea that he wouldn't be able to, and thus contract gets broken.
Can I just follow up on what Wayne said about the how to use a contract in the game? It is very difficult. And I think one of the difficulties is when there's too many contracts.
Right.
Or too many individual contracts. And I think the contract should be special in that it should be a fairly major story element. And that makes it a lot of fun. And, I mean, if you watch a movie like Darby O'Gill and the Little People, have you guys ever seen that?
I haven't, no.
Oh, no, I haven't.
And what he does with, I'm not going to say what it is. It's like a contract. If people watch that movie, which I recommend, it's a Disney movie. Sean Connery, pre-James Bond Sean Connery.
Does he play a fairy?
He does not play a fairy.
And I meant something of a sprite.
I play an Irishman. Who sounds a little bit like a Spaniard. Sorry. I thought I'd play an Irishman via Spain.
How does that relate to fairies?
Not at all. But Wayne and I were doing Sean Connery as a Smaug.
Oh, yeah.
Why they didn't have him as the voice actor for Smaug in The Hobbit. I'm sorry, is my Russian accent a little too much for you?
Don't I sound like a dragon?
But, yeah, no, there's like one contractor, so to speak, and It's a major scene in the movie, you know, and it's very interesting. I think the contracts should be major scenes in your story.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And as you said, Lau, the contract should be special. Hold on a second.
Yeah, that's exactly what he said.
Sorry. I'll do that again. Now, as you said, Lau, the contract should be special. And I liked how the Changeling the Law setting had mechanics for building a contract. But you just couldn't do them during the game. But that's kind of the point of the contract, in my opinion. Like, the one contract we tried to use, I had one set up as the game master, set up and just kind of wanted your characters to sign something. And of course, you guys all said, you know, heck no, we're not going to do that. That sounds terrible. And you wanted to modify the contract on the fly, which I eventually let you do, just to kind of move the story along. But, yeah, it needs to be something that is kind of come up with on the fly, and it might be hard to do since, as we're talking about, like, fairies are, like, really honest, but then you gotta look for loopholes and stuff, so the wording of the contract is really important, which can be easy to miss or kind of mess up when you're just kind of doing it on the fly, and later on you're like, oh no, that's not what I said, oh crap, you know, I meant to say this, but...
Hey, can I jump in here for a sec?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
I don't think that that's actually a downside. I think that could work very well for you. You know, if someone's wording is poorly done when they make the contract, then that's a huge twist that they have to deal with, especially if we're making the contract an important part of the game.
Absolutely, on the part of, like, the mortal, the person interacting with the fairy. Mm-hmm. But, and, yeah, like, ultimately, in most of these stories, the human finds the loophole in the fairy's contract, but generally I think that fairies should be pretty smart about what they're doing. And if you, as the game master, kind of like stumble over the wording, and then the player goes, "Oh, done," you're like, "Well, crap." You know, that should have been a lot more interesting. And because I couldn't think on my feet, there's that idea gone. You know, that's kind of more what I was thinking.
That's true, but you know, with the natures of fairies, they their ideas behind what certain things mean or what they are, you can probably bend a little bit what the actual wording is, depending on. Of course, you wouldn't want to go too far because then it's kind of like cheating the players.
Yeah, exactly, then you're being the dick GM. No, I didn't mean that. Oh, come on.
But you do have some leeway, I think.
Again, I think it has to deal with whether or not is it a major part of the story, or is it every time you do a transaction with somebody, they're going to bring out a contract?
Welcome to lawyer world.
Not being facetious. No, but Changeling is like that. Is that they're all fairies?
Yeah.
So contracts are very much not necessarily a daily thing, but a fairly regular thing, and that can lead into contract fatigue, or at least everybody's fairly savvy when it comes to contracts.
Right.
Which can be quite interesting, and everybody's trying to one up each other, but it also just means like enough already.
You're playing lawyer, the RPG.
Yeah, and as a game master, I wouldn't want to try and keep track of all the different contracts flying around.
Right.
Well, I wrap my head around conditions and
details. Yeah, like a couple key contracts that can have a major impact on the story are a lot better than a lot of little contracts that you're making.
Agreed.
No, we brought it up last episode, but Monster Hearts has the Fae skin, and they're all about making promises and what happens when those promises get broken. And I think that's a good way to do it. Of course, it only kind of has like one fairy in the group. Yeah. But
I think that one, it's a little bit easier, that one, because there's two things. First off, it's not necessarily contracts, it's promises. And you're dealing with regular people who probably don't know that you are a fairy. So they're making promises as a human would, not knowing of the consequences, but you're the one who's keeping these promises and kind of backing them up afterwards. And the other thing is that kind of is the whole focus of that class in the Monster Hearts game. So if someone chooses that class, that's what they're going for. That's what they're interested in. So it's probably not something that they're going to get overwhelmed by. Whereas somebody who's playing Changeling, you know, they're trying out a RPG, and it might not be the part that's interesting to them. It might be playing a fairy or, you know, something.
I think that's a way for the GM to take it, then, if they're running like a fairy character, rather than worry about contracts. And I'm not saying contracts should not be used. Just if any of the player characters, like, make a promise, then that should be binding, and the fairy will consider it binding. Kind of like, because not that I entirely disagree, but I do think promises kind of work like a contract, you know? It's almost kind of like a verbal contract. Yeah, you said you're going to do this, and here's what I said you were going to get for it, and you kind of gave your word, and now you broke it. So,
yeah, it could work. I'd add the caveat that it wouldn't work between fairies, because they all know the consequences of the contracts they're making, so I feel there'd be a lot more negotiation between them. But in a case of mortals and fairies, then yeah, I think it probably is a good way of going about it.
And kind of, that brings us to our next element, which is a bit different from contracts, which you imagine are fairly rigid, but that is that the fairies are quite capricious. Mm-hmm. I think Wayne and Chris were a little bit split on this, because...
Yeah, what were we saying, Chris? I think you were saying that, like...
Something about good and evil.
Yeah.
Did we disagree on that? I don't remember.
Yeah, you started to say... I think one of the things you said is you could divide fairies into, like, good fairies and bad fairies, and I said, nah, you can't really...
Ah, I see. And I still stand by that, kind of, because... It's true. I mean, part of fairy mythology is that there are good fairies and evil fairies. You've heard of the terms seelie and unseelie, which is basically, it translates to holy and non-holy, but it basically means good and evil. So, yeah, there are good fairies and evil fairies.
And I'm still going to stand by and disagree and say they're just various shades of gray. Yeah, I'm still going to disagree. I know there's like seelie and unseelie court, but I just kind of see them as various shades of gray. I mean, there
50
are...
50 shades?
No. I mean,
sorry, what? What did Chris say?
50 shades.
50 oh, yeah,
shades
yeah.
Of fairy.
Fairy bondage.
Oh, come on.
Sorry, continue.
All right. No, but I mean, there are plenty of stories of what I would consider, what would be considered like good fairies acting really maliciously and evilly. And it all kind of depends mostly on the person who interacts with them. Mm-hmm. Like, one of the stories is you know, a deformed guy with a hunchback comes across like a fairy ring, and the fairies are singing in it. And he, you know, listens and waits, and then when they finish, he kind of adds a little bit more to the song. But he had such a nice voice that they liked his song, and so they granted him a wish, and his wish was to not be deformed, right? So they took the hump off his back. And when he went home and told his neighbor, the neighbor, you know, of course, runs off and goes and doesn't wait for the correct time to sing his song and just interrupts. And, of course, the fairies, you know, get all pissed off, and then they nail the hump to his back, and then, you know, he eventually dies. So,
Is that a Japanese myth?
No, I believe it's somewhere in Europe. I couldn't pin it down, but...
My wife told me one that's the exact same of that, just a Japanese version.
Well, I think the fact that, like, you know, what could be considered fairies are found across all cultures mean there will be eventually, not eventually, but there will be sort of common stories and legends.
True.
Just kind of
both
human
fairies
nature.
And humps, yep.
Yeah. Or like, other ones are... What?
Oh, the humpback story? Oh, it's old as time. Or the hunchback, I guess.
Hey, hunchback, I don't know. But... I don't know. Yeah, I tend to think it's, yeah, you can be good, but even, yeah, like good spirits, like brownies, you do something kind of weird, like offer them clothes or food or say thank you, and they get all pissed off and run away and possibly even then start causing you problems. So, and I tend to think it's a very gray area, and you can't really divide them into good and evil, just... more and less malicious, I'll say.
I think you're totally right there, but I think that there are quite a few that that fit either directly into the evil or good category. I don't know many ogres that come in shades of gray.
Oh.
They grind children's bones into dust and for their bread, and yeah, they're pretty evil.
Fair enough. That being said, I bet if you made a contract with them, we would probably honor it.
If you said thank you to the Tooth Fairy, she probably wouldn't take out the rest of your teeth.
Well, it would have been the Hellboy Tooth Fairy, so.
I think they can be, like, whatever. I think maybe the capriciousness, the thing that I find interesting is that maybe they can change, and that, I guess it gets into the hunchback story, is that they can be different things to different people. They abide by their own set of rules.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is probably the very nature of, or definition of capriciousness, yeah.
Yeah, so it's... their morality is just not our morality. So, however we like how we deal with them is, of course, going to dictate how we view them.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to want to slap on a label that they're good or bad, but they're just them.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. Like I think that that's very important. That the fairies that's what they are. They have their own code of morality that's not equal to a human one. And yeah, that's the way to do it. I always picture them kind of as a very childlike. You know, where they're really rambunctious and overly emotional. I always thought that would be a really fun way to play them, especially if you were playing as a fairy. That'd be good fun.
It could be. It would definitely cause, like, drama.
Yeah, that's what the game's all about.
Yeah, I don't know. Again, from the Changeling book, I liked, even though you play even though you play Changeling, which are only kind of like half-fae, I really do like how the fae were presented in that book. There's a very, as Lyle said, kind of alien mindset where they have their own kind of morality and it's simply not ours and you can't really figure out what they're going to do.
The Changeling fairies were a little bit too Cthulhu for me, but it's a little bit too much in that towards that unknowable end.
I don't know. I like that. And if I was going to play fairies in a game, I think that's how I would present it. Or it kind of like the Alice in Wonderland thing. Like the characters in that, they seem crazy and I guess arguably are crazy. You know, they act without any kind of rational thought. But no, maybe it's just because we as human beings don't understand what they're doing. And to us, it looks like complete nonsense. But to whatever sensibility they have, it makes perfect sense to them.
All right, so of course what we do in every creature feature, how do you play them as antagonists and how do you play them as protagonists? And despite me saying it that order, we'll start with
all right, I was wondering.
Well, of course, like the classic game that you could look at is Changeling.
mm-hmm.
to give you ideas on how to play them. But yeah, there's different things you can do. And I mean, yeah, sure, everybody plays an elf in a fantasy game, and they're technically fairies.
Mm.
But a lot of times, elves are just played as
people with pointy ears.
Yeah, people with pointy ears who can see in the dark a little bit. Perhaps like good have some arrows. Magical affinity. What's that?
Good with arrows.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you incorporate like a some sort of fae character with which you know in their dealings with even the player characters or the NPCs, you know, certainly that contracting would be interesting to play out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be interesting. I mean, like D&D 4th edition kind of did that a little bit by saying the Eladrin were from the Feywild, you know, closer more to like the fairies. But then again, I don't know, my opinion, like most things in D&D 4e, they didn't do anything with it. It was just like, oh, people who can teleport. Great. So.
Yeah, when we were playing, we never got into it too much, but yeah, a little bit of the backstory for the Eladrin that I was playing was that if they teleport too much, they start to go a little bit crazy.
Right.
And that it wasn't really incorporated into the game because there was never any need, but that they can actually then start teleporting like a horse. And they had a cavalry that was able to teleport with their horses, which made them, of course, extremely effective because they can teleport beyond any barrier to then hit you with the charge. But to move that much mass through the Feywild meant that they very quickly became insane, and that to join the these knights was not necessarily like a death sentence, but certainly a sacrifice. They would sacrifice their sanity in order to do it. But very much just playing up on you're part of two worlds, and you can only do that so long.
Right.
And eventually, you need either choose a world, or if you're always on the edge, then that's going to cost you. I think Changeling does a little bit with that, because they do have the hedge.
I think that's kind of ultimately the whole point of Changeling, at least the Lost, because, you know, you eventually do reduce your glamour score low enough, and you can become mortal, and you lose all your powers. Or, you know, if your clarity drops too low, you eventually just kind of tear your way back into Arcadia and the Fey Realms, and that's it. So, yeah, the point of the game is to kind of play that razor's edge and do both, but you know, that was kind of hard to do.
I think it's hard to do when you're an entire party.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Because you always kind of have that support network. You know, there's other people, like, despite it being called Changeling the Lost, and you're supposed to be, like, outcasts with, you know, kind of, like, no safety net. Well, you always have these 2, 3, 4 other people around you who are kind of exactly like you.
Yeah, it's kind of hard with Changeling because Changeling, you're not fully playing fairies. You're playing humans who've found themselves in kind of a fairy-esque situation, walking the line between two worlds. But their mind, at its most basic, is still human. So it's kind of, it's not that far into it. It's more, that's more fairies as a setting than it is fairies as a character. I've never actually played a game where the whole party is a bunch of fairies. And I think that would be a lot of fun. I think it would actually turn out very similar to like a Monster Hearts game, because I think with the capriciousness and, again, in my view, kind of the childish nature of fairies, you could have really dramatic interactions between people that kind of go over the top. And that was a lot of fun with the Monster Hearts, is kind of playing an overly emotional teenager. So I see a party of fairies. This could be a really cool thing to do.
Yeah, like I'm a huge fan of Monster Hearts and like fairies, but I don't know, I tend to think that you might...
don't get me wrong.
But your idea sucks.
No. What I'm going to say is, like, if the players are continually playing these sort of, like, childish, over-the-top people, my question is, will it eventually become forced? Will it be kind of like metagaming, where you say, you know, well, I wouldn't normally do this, but, hey, I'm kind of a crazy, out-of-control fairy, so that means I'm going to do it, even though I kind of don't really want to as a player?
I suppose that could be a danger, yes.
I mean, there's different ways you can do that. I mean, you can do the kind of a meta system, do something like Two-Face.
Mm.
You know, you flip the coin and you let that make your decisions for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in a sense, yeah, it's kind of forcing an issue, but it's also, it can be a lot of fun, and it, yeah, it is hard to play crazy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, it's easy to play crazy when it benefits you, but it's hard to play crazy when it's gonna mess you up. Of course, you know, the downside is how it affects the players around you.
Yeah. But if everybody's
but
crazy.
But if I guess if you're all, yeah, I
don't know,
I can
I'm not
see
trying
that
to sell
just
play crazy, like a bunch of Melkavian vampires or something, but more childish. Which is something that everyone has had experience with. You know, we all know what children act like. We've all been there at one point.
So we get to sit around and call each other duty heads all the time.
Well, we do that anyway, dude.
All right, fair enough.
I suppose the other way of going about it is if you have a party that's not all fairies and one or more players in that are playing them, in which case it's, I think it kind of goes back to the ghost thing where you'd have to be really careful not to let the player just become a tool of the party, you know, because they have whatever special magic power or can turn invisible or whatever other fairy abilities that they have.
Well, again, I would argue that's where the contract or the promises would come in, because, like, the fairy, in my opinion, the fairy character wouldn't just not do a contract or a promise just because the other people have a PC aura around them. They'd be like, no, okay, you want me to do that? Great. You got to promise me something, because that's simply how fairies work.
Yeah, that's a great way to go around it. Or buy that, yes. I actually did that once. We played a Rifts game, and I played a character, a fairy in it. We did one of those things where you just kind of flip through a bunch of the books and try to find, choose whatever race you come up with.
The power gamiest race ever?
Fairies weren't that bad compared to, like, dragons or, what were they? Not the Cyber Knights, the Cosmo Knights. Yeah.
But what's this?
I played a fairy in a game once, a one shot.
Which game?
Rifts.
Rifts?
Yes.
Oh. I thought you said Rifts.
He's hungry.
I prefer Rifts over Rifts.
Because Rifts have Cyber Knights.
Yes, it does.
Not Cosmic Knights.
It has Cosmo Knights.
Oh, they have them as well.
Yes.
Oh.
Hey, Rifts got everything. That's why it's Rifts.
The Cosmonites are one of the most power gamiest power munchkin classes in that entire game, which is saying something.
Oh, I bet you just lost us a bunch of listeners.
More than the Atlantis tattooed man.
More than, yes.
Wow.
Man, someone had to go out of their way to break them then.
They could fly around in space at super light, super luminal speeds with their suits of giant golden armor and shoot giant lasers that could knock out spaceships all by themselves.
Oh, they're like glitter boys in space.
Yeah. They would tear a glitter boy in half, but yes. Anyway, let's get off of Rift.
I was gonna say, yeah, bringing it back to fairies.
So yes, I see that playing a fairy in a campaign with other fairies or even just with a regular party, I think it would be a lot of fun. And I'd like to try it in a non-Rifts version. Yeah. You're looking up Cosmonites, aren't you, Lyle?
Yeah. That's in the Phase World. You're a big fan of Phase World.
I am, yes.
Antagonist. I think a fairy's can be quite interesting. Antagonist in that. Yeah, especially if you play up the capriciousness. Mm-hmm. But also, of course, the contract.
Yeah.
And how you do that. And I think that's what the Shades of Grey is that Wayne is talking about. They always have a chance, or you always have a chance with the fairy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Because if they do offer the contract, or you do utilize that, which of course we recommend, then it's all just about manipulating that. And that can lead to a pretty good end scene. Mm-hmm. Or final scene. Which doesn't necessarily have to boil down to, like, let's just fight.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. Like, I see it as a really good challenge that doesn't involve combat. Because, like, as we said at the beginning, like, fairies can be pretty much anything. And they can, you know, have all this power. And what are you going to do to a fairy? You probably can't kill it, you know, no matter what magic you have. Because it's a fairy. You can be whatever you want. So great. How do you get out of this contract that you stupidly accepted? Well, you got to find the loophole, and that could be really fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, when I was thinking about what kind of antagonists you could use fairies as, I mean, you can use them to fill any role that you want. You can have them just be the basic baddies when you're talking about, like, goblins or boggarts or something. You could use them as the villain if you have, like, the Unseelie King or something like that. But yeah, just like you guys are saying, the best way to use them is make them use their contracts and their inhuman codes of morality against the players. Because that way it's kind of a moral dilemma. These creatures aren't evil, but they're doing what comes naturally, and unfortunately it's just kind of screwing you over. So how do you deal with that? How do you get yourself out once you've got it in?
Yeah.
As an aside to that, I mean, you could also have fairies as your allies. They're trying to help you, but the way that they're helping is tearing your life apart. There's a story out of the Changeling book where a farmer, he saves a fairy, and to repay him, the fairy makes all of his farm tools do the work for him, so they kind of float around reaping wheat by themselves, etc. But unfortunately, all the other townspeople see this, and they think that it's witchcraft, so no one will buy from him, no one will deal with him. So it turns out that this help is a curse. And you could play with that for the players.
Yeah, I read a very similar story that wasn't in the Changeling book. It was an actual kind of like a legend where, yeah, the threshing machine was enchanted by fairies, and you know, the guy, you know, pulled in all his harvest, threshed all his wheat, but the problem was that the machine just kind of kept going, and it ended up doing his neighbor's fields as well. And so the choice the farmer had is either, you know, tell the fairies to stop helping him and risk their wrath or their ire, or like take the grain he was being given and try and explain why, you know, he now had his neighbor's grain from all the fields, and it would look like he was stealing. So
yeah,
kind of like all you got is two bad choices.
Exactly. A fairy's help can be just as harmful as a fairy's wrath.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, and that's why when we say antagonist, we don't necessarily mean enemy or villain. We just mean something opposite to the protagonist. No, I think definitely people need to watch Derby of Gion the Little People.
All right, it's on my list.
And see how King Brian deals with Derby. It's kind of like a love-hate relationship. So. It's pretty good. It's better than Leprechaun.
Better than Leprechaun.
But it's just like you're kind of limited in the number of fairy. Although Hellboy 2
right.
provided some very, very nice images of like a fairy court.
Yes, it did. Mm-hmm. The other one I was thinking of was Pan's Labyrinth.
Ah, yes, very good one.
Yeah,
it's pretty good.
Yeah,
and again, it has a lot to do with contracts and, you know, kind of like rules and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Good ending too.
Mm. Which Chris will spoil. No.
All right. Another thing to look at is Brian Froud. His illustrations. He made lots of books on fairies and dragons and giants and things like that back in the '70s and eighties. Some absolutely beautiful things. That's always what I hark to when I think of fairies. Also, there's a movie a few years back called Spiderwick, and it's kind of just a kid's fairy movie. It's still pretty good, but all of the CG fairies that are shown in that are based on his illustrations. It's absolutely beautiful.
Oh, well, I was going to say.
Oh, I...
God, Lau.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a really good book, or a series of books.
The Spiderwick Chronicles?
Yeah.
No, yeah, I haven't read them, but the movie is, again, it's made for a younger audience, but it's a good movie.
I'll have to check it out. Well, you know, Brian Froud, he did all the kind of like creature stuff for Labyrinth and Dark Crystal. So,
yes.
Don't know why I didn't mention Labyrinth again, because that's another perfect contract one, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, with the Goblin King.
Yeah, and David Bowie and his bowls and crotch, yeah.
Even as a boy.
No, it's because my sister watched that stupid movie 24/7.
And she told you about his bulging crotch?
No, well, you only got one TV in the house. Is that or nothing?
So, I could read a book or watch a man's crotch. Oh, watch all a man's right, crotch.
All right. I must have a fairy enchanted shovel. It just keeps digging.
Oh, yeah. I could read a book or I could go to the gay bar. Well, whatever.
Are you done?
No.
Never. All right, get it all out.
So that brings us to the end of Creature Feature Fairies. So we looked at the different elements that you could use. Certainly there's a lot more that you can do with fairies, and it's worth taking a look at both the different kinds of fairies, and also, like, as we said at the end there, well, actually, I didn't say it. looking at different art and different pictures, and that provide a lot of inspiration, which unfortunately is a limitation of a podcast and that we can't provide it for.
Video.
We can't do that on a podcast.
Thanks for joining us again on Out of Our Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or you can download it off of DriveThruRPG, or stream it through Stitcher or through iTunes. You can post comments right there on the website, or join us in our forums and say something there, or you can follow us on Facebook with a like, or on Twitter with a little follow button. Or just send us an email, because we always love hearing from all of you. So thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time. Whiskey number 2.
Mm-hmm. Yep. He's going to be slurring by the end of the cast. And let me tell you about
Ferris. I didn't think about that Josh Whedon.
Yeah. I'm back.
Okay.
That whiskey number 2 you got there.
Yeah, and some Ritz crackers. Oh, my God, I didn't eat dinner, Jesus. Shut the fuck up.
Can't wait to hear what you're like by the end of the cast. I can see fairies right now.
I need some more freaking Ritz.